And welcome to SHSK Sounds, the official podcast for St. Helen and St. Catherine.
My name is William Clements, and today I'm joined by our executive chef, Eamon Bennett,
and deputy director of operations, Becky Goodwin. They will give us an insight into the culinary world at St. Helen's, with an exclusive look into how food is sourced, prepared, and the efforts in place to minimize organic waste and single-use plastics. Good morning, guys. Thank you for coming on today.
Morning.
So to get started, Eamon, could you briefly tell us how you got to where you are now?
I've been a chef since I was in the kitchen since I was 16 years old. I'd left school on a Tuesday. I started work on a Thursday, and I've been in and around the industry ever since.
Eamon, when you come to choose a menu, what is it that you're considering?
The initial idea is, what will the girls like? Also, can I make enough of it in the time we've got? Can I cook it in the right way for that number? And does it cost something what I'm looking to spend? And then it moves on to, would it be seasonal at that time of the year? Is the supply chain in sort of good order and stuff like that? And sort of bring it together from that way. But ultimately, it starts with what will hundreds of young children or young adults like to eat.
So top priority is making good food.
Absolutely.
And do you tie in quite closely together when you're making a menu? So you'll propose an idea of whatever it might be for the week, and then do you take that to Becky?
Becky would sort of talk about the menu cycle and things like that would have as a structure. And then really the emphasis is on me to fill that space. If you imagine an empty menu that we've discussed, we'll do a three-week menu cycle, for example. Then a bit like what we're speaking about today, what sort of things we have on there, what sort of things we need to maybe look at reducing on there, them sort of things, and then really I'll put that together.
So how reactive are you? Is it a case of you put forward a three-week menu cycle that starts? Do you start straight away planning the next cycle?
Yes, but also I would say that in my time here, the three-week menu cycle has never got back to week one to start again and been the same.
Yeah, and I imagine, given the recent year supply chain issues, that may well have impacted.
Exactly. So very recently, there was an absolute shudder through like bacon and them sort of gammons and stuff like that. And I was able to just immediately withdraw or sort of process pork, if you like, for a while.
So when it comes to selecting food, as Eamon said, your top priority is producing food that will effectively be eaten. What comes next? Are you looking at price? Are you looking at sustainability?
Both of those, to be honest with you. Price, obviously, is crucial. We use a procurement company, so they are constantly updating us on where food prices are at and what are good buys, what are bad buys at the moment, different market fluctuations. We're kind of keeping an eye on all the time. And as Eamon said, he constantly reviews what he's offering based on those two things, so price being one, sustainability, locally sourced, etc., being another. Obviously, last year we had huge price fluctuations, increases of above 19%, which we had to consider the whole time, which we did really well to look at, adapted the menu. I think we ended up 12% over on our budget last year, which, considering the massive hike, I think that's a huge achievement.
How did you manage to do that?
Literally changing, adapting the menu to suit the price fluctuations. If we saw that something was hiking, we'd change or adapt the menu to suit to find something cheaper. Literally kind of keeping an eye on the market at every given time.
Well, that must have been good fun with your planning.
It's definitely a challenge, but I think really it really is a test of discipline as well, because in an environment like a school, it can be very tempting to just play to the audience on any given day and put something on that is neither in season, sustainable or cost effective, because you want the sort of the glory, if you like. And as a chef, you can chase that if you're not too careful. And so actually what we did with the menu is constantly look at things that all the school will more or less want to eat.
So you've chosen your menu and you want to make it sustainable and you've got the price right. Does your supplier actually tell you what impact that food has? So for instance, let's say we're talking about chicken. Do you know where that chicken's come from and how it's been fed?
Well, yes, but the onus really is on us to look into that thing. At some point, the suppliers we use as well, are very open, very forward-thinking, but they're also, at the end of the day, are still there to be a business and sell you meat. So the onus is very much on us to ask them questions and do their investigations, and they cooperate fully.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think what they do nowadays, which has changed a lot over the last few years, is that everything is traceable.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And more locally sourced.
Provenance is everything, yeah.
Yeah, and I think companies out there, procurement companies such as Alban Hall, are having to think a little bit more about, okay, we need to be doing locally sourced produce, not pulling it in from China or Spain or wherever it might come from, which again is up there on Eamon's radar from a sustainability point of view.
Absolutely, yeah.
Are students involved with menu selection at all?
Yes, absolutely. So a culture that I would always try and make anyone aware of is that, so initially the sort of open door policy, my email address is often given out, or I'll speak to them individually on a day-to-day basis, just so that the first, very first thing is that the perception of me and my team is that we're listening, and we want to hear what they have to say, so that if they think of something they would suggest or want to ask, I think maybe the perceptions of catering and kitchens would be, well, I'm not going to say that to the chef, or they're not going to want to hear that, and what I really try and push forward. I know we do want to hear that, and especially with the sort of, in terms of food trends, actually one of the biggest things at the moment is young people are really leading the way and are really asking questions about what they're eating and stuff like that. So from my point of view is that we're side by side or meeting them halfway on that. There's been a couple of times where sixth formers and I've worked together for, could be a vegetarian week we've done before. We did a meat-free Monday for a while. And all these things have come to me from sixth formers. So, you know, that works so well because they're pushing forward an agenda that is important. And it gives me something really positive to work with them on. You know, and at the end of the day, it's in my absolute interests that my relationship with the students is a positive one. And this is a really nice, accessible way to meet them and say, yes, let's absolutely do this together. And that's happened several times. And really, it's like a sort of a resource that I have to absolutely get everything I can from. They're the people with the ideas, to be honest.
So you've sourced the food, you've cooked the food with backing from students.
Mm-hmm.
How do you then monitor how successful a dish is?
There are various ways. An obvious one is feedback. But then there's much more practical ways of looking at it. So, and it's about bringing them all together so that you're looking at all the different aspects. What are we selling at lunchtime? What's being requested most as they're coming through the counter? But of course, the absolute important other aspect of that is the other end. So maybe, you know, 600 people have all chosen one choice, and that's a very popular dish. Was it very popular when they ate it? So you're looking at what's being thrown away afterwards and putting the two sides of that together. So if you're selling hundreds and hundreds of a particular dish and by and large the plates are empty, then you've really got yourself a favourite. Yesterday, for example, with the bao buns on, we sell all the bao buns and there are none being thrown away afterwards. So that's the sort of the golden ticket. I can order with confidence, we can cook it with confidence, knowing that they're all going to be popular. For the dishes that at the end of a lunch, there are trays left of, we're looking at what it's been put up against. So if you put on something quite popular normally, but you put it against bao buns are going to win. So maybe you put it on and you're looking at what you're pairing on a menu. You're looking at how we presented it and that sort of trend that might be going through food at that particular time. But also, sometimes you have an idea as a chef, you put it out there and it just doesn't really land. It can happen, and you have to be big enough to say, thought it was going to be a good idea, turns out the people we're serving did not necessarily agree. And at that point, you suck it up and you replace it and move on.
So with the less popular dishes, what happens to that? Does it go in the bin straight away?
So what we do, I'm sure my team would prefer that I said I, invite a bit of pressure on us by doing as much as we can on the day. And traditionally, a place that does the numbers we do, what kitchens will often do is day before. And there's a sort of general sort of thing in catering of day one for day three. Now, obviously, some of the high risk ingredients, not so, but you're always prepping ahead, so that on any given day, you're ready to go. Now, you have to maintain that because that's good practice. You can't manage otherwise. But when it comes to cooking a meat ingredient or something that you can only cook in that way, we try and do it on the day. Now, with food, with reheating food, with reusing food, you get two chances to cook a food item. So if you cook it the day before in a prep way, then you cook it on the day for lunch. Let's take a lasagna, for example. Historically, if you like, you make that a day before with the cook the mince off, and then you just finish it off on the day. However, if you finish that off on the day and you've cooked that then twice going out for lunch, if there's any trays left over or there's any left over, you've had your two cooks and it's over and it has to be discarded at that point. So we'll cook the mince on the day before, then make it, then put it in the oven. So it's all one cooking process. So if there's any left over, we chill it in our blast chiller, brings it down to temperature quickly and safely, store it, wrap it, and then as long as you reheat that to the necessary temperature again, it's completely the right way to do it, completely safe. And so that means that we can reuse dishes in a completely appropriate and safe way. It just means that on that morning, perhaps a couple of my chefs would prefer to come into work knowing the bolognese mix for lasagna was already cooked and they just need to put it together. This way they're cooking it, then putting it together. Bit more pressure, but it means that we're not throwing that away at the end of the day. And once you get into that rhythm, it works very well.
I think one thing you guys have got really, really hot on recently, certainly in the last year and a half, 2 years, is repurposing food as well, mm-hmm. which is not dissimilar to what you've already talked about, but actually rather than freezing an item, it's repurposing for the next day. So it could be risotto is repurposed as arancini the next day. Yeah. So pulling those items that haven't necessarily all gone and actually putting them out again the next day as something really exciting, new and different, for sure. Meaning that we're not actually throwing that food away at the end of the day.
And it demands, I think, that you're creative, and it demands that you, if you take something left over and keep churning it out the same, it's not really a great look, regardless of how safe you can say you've done it. People are, didn't we have that the other day or something? So it really does demand that you're creative within them boundaries. And I think, as you say, the risotto to the arancini one is an absolute, the greatest example a chef will ever find of using up leftovers. Because there's arancini on, eyes light up. Oh my gosh, you've made arancini! And I'm all for the plaudits of that. And I will often not go into the full story of how we decided to make arancini that day. But it's a really creative way of reusing something that maybe you've got left over.
Yeah, and I think by doing all of those things that you just talked about, obviously our food waste has reduced hugely.
I think in my team, it's been from the moment I got there, certainly, of really, really pushing that to become, I keep saying the word culture, but these things don't happen because I decided they're going to happen. It has to be team-wide. Everyone has to buy into it. So every lunch service, every post-lunch service, we'll analyse what we've got, what we've not got. And I don't mean sort of a formal meeting with charts and PowerPoints, but we'll literally stand over the food that we've just served. And some days we'll get down to half a dozen of something left over for lunch, which when you consider that my team then have their lunch, it's like picking a winning lottery ticket to us. It's absolutely golden where you get the amounts really, really spot on. We've now got how many we're selling at the end of the day, so we know we can confidently order the right amount. If we do, this is what we're going to do with it the next day, and this is what we're going to do with it the next day. And it's basically meant that the food waste that we have at the end of a lunch is never perfect. But it's really reduced significantly, and I can confidently sort of feel that it's only going to go one way.
So if you can't repurpose the food into soups or your arancini, what happens to it next?
So obviously with every kitchen there's going to be a certain amount of food waste, whether that's leftover that can't be repurposed, as you said, or the majority, to be honest, would be food plate scrapings. So where the girls have maybe taken a little too much of something, which is something obviously we try to avoid by talking to them. But you're inevitably going to have leftovers on a plate. All that will obviously go into food waste bins, which over the last year we've reduced dramatically. So when I first started, we were looking at around 9 food waste bins being collected twice weekly. And we're not just talking a small bin, we're talking, you know, a 240-litre capacity bin.
Is that the sort of four-wheel industrial size
thing? Not quite those, more of a...
like a wheelie bin,
size. So last year, having reduced all the food waste, and Eamon and the team doing a fantastic job of that, we reviewed it over the summer, decided to change our supplier for two reasons. One, to reduce the number of bins and the number of times they've been collected, but also actually to look at sustainability, what was happening to those waste products. So we changed to a new supplier in September. We've reduced once weekly collections down to 6. And all that food waste now goes to produce additional energy.
Fantastic. I was actually reading into biogas recently, a little factoid for you. If food waste or the greenhouse gases from food waste were all combined together across the world, and you compared it to countries, food waste would be the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. So you'd have China, then you'd have the United States, then you'd have food waste.
Wow.
So I mean, it's staggering. So this repurposing to make your biogases is, it seems like a no-brainer.
I think, you know, it's also important for me as chef to sort of acknowledge the support that comes to that point. So as a school that has to dedicate themselves to wanting to do that, because it requires time, it requires investment. You know, the bins are new, the freezer, that we have a new freezer so that we can try and, it's a couple of stages earlier in the process, but a new freezer that reduces how much we need to throw away and things like that. And the time, as I say, that goes into making that. So it's not, you can't do it by saying, yeah, we'd like to be this sustainable champion. It requires genuine work and genuine money. And that's one thing I'm fortunate in that respect, that the school have been pretty clear, and Becky sort of directed to me, but been pretty clear about what it is we want to achieve, and here's how we're going
to
do it.
And does it mean you have to take a financial hit? Because I imagine you're actually, with these efficiency gains, reducing waste and reducing the number of bin collections.
I'd say it's an initial outlay I don't think you can avoid, but eventually it starts to pay for itself. And that's the great thing with sustainability. Once you're doing it, once you're up and running, the knock-on effects stretch beyond that. It'll make it cheaper because you're buying less food in, because you'll be using it. You know, once you start on that road to sustainability, the knock-on effects are just all positive, really. I think if you plan it properly and you say, well, we need these bins, we need this freezer, we need the staff to buy into this, this is how we're going to lead it. And by making that sort of strong, clean break at the beginning, after that, the effects are beneficial.
And I think now it's what I've looked at this week with Eamon is picking out key items now where, okay, what could we do to reduce the amount of cooking oil that we're using, for example, which is a fairly big spend item. What can we do? And then actually, what's happening to that cooking oil at the end of the week? Is it going to a sustainable source at the end of the day? So that's the next thing we're looking at is, okay, our waste, our food waste goes to energy. Could our cooking oil do the same thing? So it's about selecting those items now going forward, isn't it? We've kind of done the big picture, which is reducing as much as we possibly can. And now it's looking into items and seeing, okay, what can we do with that? What can we change with that? What do we need to be looking at going forward?
Are the students aware of where their food is coming from?
I would say, I think I've touched on it earlier, the biggest difference I can notice as someone that's been in the industry for 25 years or something, that is the biggest change, is that more and more students now want to know rather than just sitting down at a table and eating what's in front of them. And I think as a department, it's our responsibility to make sure that we are ready to meet that challenge and educate from within the industry. We have a good relationship with the butcher that we use. They do all sorts of initiatives for sort of field-to-fork days to explain the whole process and show where that animal was came from.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation, that one, because, and it is something that, again, another project on the radar, hopefully, which is something we're going to put in place in Easter, is actually adding our CO2 emissions to our two main dishes.
Yeah, exactly.
So that the girls can actually see, okay, the emissions are lower. Is that because it's locally sourced, perhaps? Is it because it's the type of product? Hopefully from Easter onwards, we'll be able to mark those in a red, amber, green, colour-coded CO2 emissions output, which will be really interesting. And kind of the start of that road, hopefully, and something that we can push out to the majority of products.
I think if we're moving along in that way, this is how you make real difference. Because it's, yes, the girls will know, the students will know, but actually, you know, even in my team, chefs over the years, you just go for your order book, say you're doing a fresh vegetable food delivery, you just write two of these, three of these, four of these, five of these, whatever. And actually what this journey is going to show everybody involved in is what's causing more damage, what's actually quite a positive thing to order at that time. And it's by getting everybody from all angles involved in this thought process, that's how you're going to make some real difference.
Yeah, it'll give the girls a choice. They can look at the items on offer and actually go, okay, that's really huge emissions on that. That's a red flag against that one. They have the choice then. Do we actually go with that? And obviously, is that going to have an impact going forward on menu choices? It's going to be a really interesting conversation in it, you know, this time next year, perhaps. You know, did girls change their choice because of that? And therefore, our menu choices will need to change and reflect the way girls' choices are being made.
As a chef, you know, just from a sort of selfish career perspective and development point of view, it's a really interesting journey to be on. It will lead to its conclusions and resolve itself rather than me making this wholesome call that's going to sort of save the world, in inverted commas. We're actually going to go on this process as a school and see actually the good work we can do and the things we should do better or the things we shouldn't do at all. And my personal view is that that's unbelievably the better way to go about it.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing how it goes and hopefully talking to you both at some point down the track. But look, Becky, Eamon, thank you so much again for coming on today.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Thank you very much.